Dear Susan, the war is getting worse. The bastards are getting more and better weapons and making use of them. For the first week I was down here, the monotonous quiet of the river lulled us into a false sense of contentment that we had the VC on the run. The only way we could get him to fight was by going into his own backyard. We went into the backyard once too often. During the previous night, a VC platoon overran an outpost next to the riverbank and set up an ambush for our river patrol boats. The battle was terrible. Sue, I thought about keeping this whole thing secret until I got home, but I can't. This war is worse than any the U.S. has fought to date. I am closer to life and death every day than the majority of men are on their last day on Earth. My values are formed around one axiom: life. Dick Strandberg, River Patrol, Section 533, Mekong Delta.
For centuries, the Mekong Delta had been the water lifeline into the heart of Vietnam. A short hour's drive from Saigon, it was also the Viet Cong's backyard. In fact, Victor Charlie was so secure in the Delta that they used its villages as a rest area for battle-weary troops. Operation Black Hawk was planned to rob the communists of their safe haven. The mission of the operation was to search and destroy enemy encampments, secure his weapons, and to crush his defense.
Well, any given day seemed like a week, but we were involved mostly in basic guerrilla operations. Also considered what we would call pickups and paybacks. A pickup would be a rescue. A payback would be an assault, but it would be an assault by not an infantry outfit. It could be, as we recall back then, Sneaky Pete's. A basic guerrilla operation where you get into an area and you perform the assigned duty, which could be to put out anything from a supply source, a transportation source, or personnel.
The operations were fast, well-planned, and coordinated with American and Vietnamese special forces and Navy SEALs. Before a Black Hawk operation was launched, the insertion teams needed intelligence. This was gathered from two sources. One was from Kit Carson's. These were Viet Cong defectors who grew tired of life in the leech-infested swamps of the Delta and now operated as scouts for the Special Forces teams. The other source was from Stay Behind teams. The Stay Behind teams were like eagles that sat on a perch surveying a specific area, waiting for enemy movement. When they spotted their prey, they would radio for support from an air mobile mic team to make a deadly strike from above.
8-0-1. I see what's happening. 9-0-5.
Successful of the Black Hawk operations occurred in early December of 1966. Two platoons of Vietnamese Special Forces and their American Green Beret advisors attacked an estimated battalion of VC. The VC were taken by surprise by the fury of the Special Forces assault, but quickly recovered from the initial shock and struck back with a vengeance.
Hell was in session. Stuff was flying and men were dying. And as we pulled back into this pod to set up a defensive position, we had a lot of casualties, a lot of dead people already, and the platoon was up front, got ate up. They were just gone. And the recon guys gave suppressing fire and held out, but when you got, you know, you hit a hornet's nest with a stick, you're in trouble. And we'd walk right into their complex, so they had everything right there to deal with us.
The SF troops laid down suppressing fire as they got on their radios and called in air support from waiting fast movers and the always welcomed gunships.
God, there was support on the horn, and Captain Buford kept things coming. We had artillery support. Jets were making passes. I instantly crawled across, checking to make sure that he hadn't put any ordnance or boom traps in there to blow up the chopper when it landed in us, because there wasn't that much room.
Still, the VC fought on, lobbing grenades and spraying fire from their AK-47s.
It was an impossible situation, just shoulder-to-shoulder fighting and keep them flying and keep them off. And when I heard those heavy machine guns, I thought, man, we're not even going to get choppers in here. They'll blow them right out of the sky coming in to us.
As the battle raged, one desperate VC assault nearly broke the fragile Special Forces line.
I think I got hit probably an hour, hour and a half. No, it wasn't even that, actually. Probably the first hour. And I looked down, and there was my buddy Clark Correll laying there with two AKs in his chest. And I hollered. First time, nobody could hear me with the volume and the intensity of the fight. I hollered a second time, and, you know, you couldn't hear one another from where we are apart. And I looked down at my buddy Clark Correll laying there, and hell, if you're going to die, you might as well do it with style. I looked at my buddy, and I said, boy, look at you, just like a C-license holder. You're a lower jumper than me in the freefall scale. And I said, just like a C-license holder, you let them kill you. The third time I hollered, it was almost as if everybody had changed magazines and stopped shooting. There was a little lull enough where I hollered. I said, we need some help over here. There's a hole in the perimeter. And at that time, my lieutenant grabbed three of the guys in the squad, and he said, get over there and help Sergeant Rock on the other side of the perimeter. And as he was pointing to me to come and help for the position, the grenade came in and blew me up. On the other side where I was looking up at one of the guys over there on the other side of my buddy laying there. His eyes got big. And Cunningham, one of the recon guys in the recon platoon with Correll, we both ended up laying down over him, not knowing if there was somebody coming through, they needed to shoot at me. You know, we couldn't turn around, so get out of the way so that guy could shoot. And as we laid down and covered him, the grenade blew up. And my lieutenant says to this day, and the guys that were, you know, they all watched it, and they said, damn, Rock, I don't know how you made that. That should have killed you. You know, we watched you die with that frag. Everybody was on the ground like a snake. I mean, you couldn't raise your head above. You're going to get a hole in it. And I, with the shock and where I was at, my state of mind, that concussion, I stood up, held out my arm. I'm standing up. And I'm looking at the blood funneling out over this eye, and I'm just, oh, man. And about that time, one of the recon medics, Washburn, he said, damn it, Fitz, he said, lay down so I can put a tourniquet on you, bleeding to death.
Finally, after 5 hours of nonstop battle, the spent communist battalion vanished into the jungle, leaving behind 75 dead and most of their heavy equipment and supplies. The SF warriors had intercepted an enemy force that was planning to overrun a nearby friendly village. Their action not only saved the village, but also took the enemy strike force out of the war for many months. As the Blackhawks began to break the communist hold on the Delta, the war in the highlands was heating up, and America was about to throw more fuel on the fire. In northern Thailand, just a few miles from the Laotian border, is the city of Udom. Based there through much of the war was a wing of Air Force RF-101s. The RF-101 was not your usual warbird. Unarmed and alone, they flew over the most hostile and heavily defended enemy territory in all of Southeast Asia. The tactical reconnaissance pilots who flew these ships acted as the eyes of the U.S. military in Nam. Most Americans back stateside never knew they even existed, but the enemy was well aware of their mission and what effect their all-seeing eyes could have on the communist plans in the South. To down an RF-101 was what the SAM missile crews trained and lived for.
Perhaps you haven't realized, but here in Vietnam, there are two distinct types of war being fought. South of the demilitarized zone, the action is on the ground. It's an army war. And the air forces are being used in direct support of this ground action. In the north, There is no ground war. The war is being fought in the air, and the air forces are being used to interdict these major supply routes to stop the flow of men and supplies in support of the Viet Cong.
As the intensity of the air war grew, the recon pilots were in the air around the clock. Reconnaissance planes would look for potential targets and do bomb damage assessments. For reconnaissance pilots, photographing the target was only half the mission. An hour after the aircrafts returned to base, negatives from the various cameras began to emerge from the rapid automatic processing machines. They were then analyzed, titled, and prepared for distribution to the various commands. Among the first to view the film were the pilots who risked their lives to obtain it.
Hold it. There's the Idea rail bridge.
All right, what a picture. You have the approaches and everything real good.
The approaches have been repaired. The bridge is definitely back in business. Looks like it's ready to handle traffic.
Sergeant Palmquist, make sure that this film gets on the first available courier to headquarters.
Yes, sir. Departure time is 14:20.
It's obvious the bridge is completely serviceable now. Zim, when was the last time we struck this target?
About 3 weeks ago.
Well, I'll bring this information to the general's attention right away. The enemy can carry a lot of materiel over this target, sir.
After the Department of Defense and the wing commanders had a chance to review the photos, orders are sent to the appropriate squadron. F-105 Thunder Chiefs, out of an airbase in Thailand, rolled down the runway to take out the bridge. Smoke and dust from the bombs often made it difficult for the strike pilots to assess the extent of the damage. Dodging enemy surface-to-air missiles and heavy ground fire, they head for home. The bomb damage assessment is left up to the reconnaissance air crews. As they prepare for their mission, they know that unlike the bombers, their visit won't be unexpected. This time, the enemy will be ready and waiting. With a flight plan established and a final briefing under their belts, they were airborne. As they flew over the zone, they could see that the strike was successful. One bridge span line shattered in the water, and a nearby railroad line severed. But the enemy wasted no time in repairing the damage, and in a matter of days, the same air crew would be back to take out the bridge once again. In Vietnam, the enemy's respect for American air power was so great that the movement of men and supplies during the daylight hours was virtually non-existent. When darkness fell, work was over for most crews who flew over North Vietnam. For the night flyers, it just began. The air crews plotted against a number of enemies, MiG fighters, anti-aircraft artillery from the ground, and SAM missiles. Then, there was the hazard of flying over hostile territory on the deck in total darkness.
This would be, our 23rd night mission tonight. We've got 45 total counters now over North Vietnam. Big difference between the day and the night jobs, of course, is that all your night stuff is at low altitude. Dodging around the mountains, watching out for rocks. And the navigation problems in this part of the world are really quite serious. It's a good thing we have a navigator in the airplane. Never Never be able to hack it with that one. Big thing that gets to us. Some nights, we're the only airplane going up into the north, and when you think we're the only Americans over North Vietnam, it kind of makes you wonder just a little bit, you know. What am I doing here?
Among the sensing devices, night reconnaissance used photo flash cartridges to photograph targets such as supply routes and nocturnal activity along the coast and the harbor. As the plane approached the target area, the pilot extinguished the running lights. Then the photo flash cartridges were ejected, and a light sensor triggered a camera mechanism. Results of the night's work, troops moving along a country road, are discovered and targeted for an early morning surprise. The North Vietnamese may have been able to hide during the daylight hours, but they could not hide from the eyes that saw in the night. It was rush hour on the highway to Thanh Son Nhut Air Base in Saigon. Thanh Son Nhut was a hub of military air operations in Southeast Asia. From there, a different kind of tactical reconnaissance operation was flown.
Doctor, that aft station has a high priority film in it. Forward station has a low altitude fan. So get them downloaded into the processor. Anything wrong with the back seat? Uploaded, turned around, Doctor. We just landed from a mission up west of Pleiku in support of ground forces. The weather was kind of bad, low clouds, but we didn't get any ground fire. I'll tell you about the mission in just a moment. Hi, Salinas.
You had a good flight, sir?
Oh, pretty good. It rained on us a little bit. As I was saying, these visual and photo missions represent the top priority in support of the ground forces here in South Vietnam by attack wrecking forces. Our workhorses for this job are the RF-101 Voodoo for a day photo and the RF-4C Phantom 2 for the day and night role. The Phantom 2 is a brand new aircraft in the inventory, and it's doing a magnificent job over here for attack wrecking in support of the Army. I suppose that we shoot up about the equivalent of the whole area of South Vietnam each month in support of the ground forces. And we fly right over them when they're in contact with the enemy or with Charlie. And I say shoot up, I don't mean to say that we're fighter pilots. Fighter pilots go boom and bang and zap, and we just go click, click. Sort of fill them with film, you might say. Now, after it goes into the photo lab and is processed and printed, we turn it over to the delivery and the courier aircraft, and they deliver it right to the Army commander in the field. And he takes it, studies it, and uses it to fight with.
Dagger 3-0, am presently following your route from Charlie Papa 3-2 at the road junction on the Mosaic. Observe you're in the clearing in the danger area. Have you any contact yet? Over.
Negative. I've checked my Mosaic. I'm approximately 200 meters from the location. I have made contact.
Damage 9-5, understand. Have a back in the area. We'll contact you on command push. Am requesting an immediate
500 hide rags, 8 and 20 mic mics. Over. Rider, I'm coming back.
Sidewinder 2-1, Dagger 3-0, over.
This is Sidewinder 2-1, over.
Dagger 3-0, BC Base Camp, Ordnance, X-ray Tango, 886-248. Request immediate airstrike. Unit on the ground, We'll contact you. Command push. Over.
Roger. Sidewinder 2-1 copy. We'll request an immediate.
Besides providing information on new targets and bomb damage assessments, the findings of the photo interpreters led to updating maps and enemy defensive positions. It was a paradox in a way. All of those men, those who kept the cameras rolling in the aircraft, the camera maintenance men working around the clock, repairing and checking intricate mechanisms, the men on the line who know how much the pilots depend upon conditions of their aircraft, and the pilots themselves, all those people, plus millions of dollars in planes, fuel, and support equipment, all had one common goal: collecting images on an inexpensive strip of celluloid. After processing, the film went directly to the photo interpreters for analysis. They were specialists who were trained to read between the lines, to ferret out concealed information and interpret visual nuances, which revealed a wealth of intelligence data. Like detectives, they scanned the photos for telltale evidence of the enemy's whereabouts and changes in his defense system. One photo might have contained information that could have changed the course of a battle or even affect the outcome of the war. But the men who made the sacrifice for the end product were the pilots and the navigators. They were the hunters and the hunted, the gamblers staking their lives on their courage, intelligence, and flying skills. Most would have to admit that the only thing standing between them and the surface-to-air missile was a healthy dose of luck. When you know the odds against these men and their loss ratio, you're hardly prepared to hear them talk so casually.
My own personal remembrance of that particular mission was being able to roll up on the side and look down underneath the aircraft and see two smoke trails from missiles going underneath me, to look behind me and to be able to see two missiles going past my tail at my wingman, and to look up between the two aircraft. I was rolled up here, my wingman here, in a scissors, and see two more missiles come between us, a simultaneous intercept by six surface-to-air missiles, all of which we're very thankful missed.
I took a pretty direct hit, a lethal hit from a surface-to-air missile, and we were cruising at 30,000 feet at the time, and I had to leave the airplane. The airplane did explode very shortly after I ejected. Got the chute out, and one of my major concerns in the chute on the way down was the fact that we were over hostile territory and the possibility or probability of being shot at while I was in the chute prior to landing. No one did shoot, however. I got on the ground and listening for engine noises overhead, figuring that Homer would still be in the area trying to pinpoint me. And I got a place to hide, found a hole in the rocks and holed up in the rocks and waited for help, knowing full well that these Jolly Greens, the helicopter pilots and the Sandy pilots, who were in the business of saving lives over here, would do their bloody best to get me out of that situation. And lo and behold, it wasn't very long after that I heard the engine noises, and in came the Sandys, the A1Es, and I knew that the Jollies wouldn't be too far behind.
Not long after this sequence was photographed, the same pilot was shot down again and rescued again. Whenever someone reached the magic number of 100 missions over North Vietnam, the air crew would take time out for a celebration, pilot style. Then it was back to the schedule board.
You'll note the
relationship of SAM position.
Even as these pilots were being briefed on the Thai Nguyen Iron and Steel Works, 50 miles north of Hanoi, fighter bombers were pounding the hell out of the target. Soon, the reconnaissance planes were on their way. A tough flight in any man's book. Unarmed, right into the den of the lion. Crossing the Red River, inbound to the target, the anti-aircraft gunners wake up. Thai Nguyen was just ahead. The cameras were turned on as the pilots flew straight and level, now over the target. The moment of truth. Click. Now to get the hell out of Dodge. The return trip meant running the gauntlet again. This time, surrounded by bandits, unfriendly fighters. The recon aircraft could not fight back, so the pilots pushed the throttle to the firewall, relying on speed and his skill to escape. After 2 hours of dodging missiles, flak, and MiGs, the recon bird makes it home.
Excuse me, sir. We just received the BDA photo on the steel mill strike. We really hit them hard this time, sir. We've completely destroyed the rolling mill.
What about the rail line over here?
There are hits throughout that yard.
And the steam line here?
Cut twice, sir.
That'll really knock them out of business for a while.
Yes, sir.
Say, don't we have a follow-on strike schedule against this target tomorrow morning?
Yes, sir, 0500.
The photos tell the story. The target is smashed. No need to go back today. The battle was routine. On a day like 100 that came before. And tomorrow, the same. Another day flying alone, unarmed and unafraid in Vietnam. On July 29, 1965, the 1st Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division was sent to Vietnam from division headquarters at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Most of the units sent to Vietnam, like the Screaming Eagles, were units that had won their battle streamers in Europe. But this was not to be a World War II battlefield, and the tactics would have to be rewritten in the jungles and rice paddies of Nam. For U.S. military purposes, Vietnam became divided into four areas called core areas. The first core was the area immediately below the demilitarized zone, which separated North and South Vietnam. Known as I Corps, this area was one of the worst trouble spots of the war.
Every division, every combat unit of the United States Army, Marines, and the Navy was given an AO, an area of operation that we had general freedom of movement. It was a relatively unsophisticated army in the South. These were black pajamas and pith helmets and rusty rifles from the French, you know, when they were there. In the North, no. They had artillery, they had mobility, they had discipline, they wore uniforms, they would stand and fight. And they had a logistical base. It was right across the border. I mean, they didn't have to go far to get it. Plus, they could shoot at us from across the border.
Because the U.S. command strategy was to pursue and engage the enemy wherever he might be, there were never any clearly defined fronts. With the enemy all about them, U.S. military forces in I Corps had their hands full. To address the situation in I Corps, the U.S. command organized Task Force Oregon. The men of the 101st found the enemy to be well dug in and tenacious. Digging them out and keeping them out was a full-time assignment that occupied the 101st from early May until September 1967.
We didn't do a lot of fighting tonight, and they did. We would hunker in. We would go into defensive posture at night. We would ring in. We would tighten, gather the wagons. We would try to do the best we could, send out listening posts, devices, you know, be within earshot, do all this kind of stuff, flares. But no great assaults. We reacted. We weren't trained to fight at night. But they did. They were unstructured, and they did a hell of a job, and they would infiltrate, and they would get into our britches and in our face unseen and unsighted and unsmelled and blow our buns off. Our kids were unbelievable, the training they had. Remember, the draft was still on, and we were getting kids who were coming in and doing the best they could, being trained to come over, dig a foxhole, climb in. They couldn't see the enemy. They couldn't smell the enemy. And in most cases, when you thought you were killing them, when you woke up the next day, there were no bodies. And you thought, my God, we shot up, you know, a million rounds of ammunition and there were bodies. There was some blood trail, but they took their killed and they took their wounded. And that was, from a morale standpoint, you'd shoot up all this ammunition. We took wounded, we took kills, but there was nothing out there. It was terribly difficult for that young private, that PFC, to understand that they weren't shooting a ghost.
For the 101st, Vietnam meant a change in the nature of the division. No longer would the Eagles jump into battle, but would reach their LZs by helicopter. This was the Air Mobile that was to become synonymous with the Vietnam War, and no unit was more suited or better trained to fight it than the 101st Airborne Infantry Division.
The mission of the 101st was still to go out, find, and fix, and eliminate the enemy, but they were changing the 101st to Air Mobile. We now were 101st Airborne Division, parentheses, AM, Air Mobile. We now had to think from 2.5 miles an hour, the walking speed of the foot soldier, 2.5 miles an hour, to 80 knots an hour, 80 knots, 100 miles an hour. All of the artillery that was allocated to the division, traditionally, the 105s, the 155s, we now could airlift them. We didn't have to shoot from the sea. We could go in and shoot. We could take them in, put them in at 8 o'clock in the morning, let them shoot up a 1,000 rounds, and extract them before lunch.
The American command had such confidence in the rightness of the Screaming Eagles for this new kind of war that they ordered the 2nd and 3rd Brigades of the division to Vietnam in August of 1967. The rest of the 101st arrived in Vietnam in December 1967 to join the 1st Brigade. The new troopers began to settle into life at the fire bases and camps of the 101st. Life at Camp Eagle was typical.
With the 101st, there was a mess hall, so you could get, you know, three good meals a day. There was the shower, although it was a little disconcerting because if you were the hooch maids and all that washed your clothes, also that's where they washed them at too, so that you would be there taking a shower with all the Vietnamese women doing your laundry right by you. It kind of lost all sense of modesty, what little we probably had at that point. You had a roof over your head. We had bunks. Had little compartments where you could kind of keep personal goods. And the hooch we had a pretty talented warrant officer who had cobbled together kind of a little bar out of rocket boxes and had actually done a little logo of 101st, but instead of the eagle, had a Playboy bunny, and it was the logo he had on the bar. And you could buy gin over there for about $2.75 a quart, I think. And then I got my family sent me cocktail olives over. So we could actually have kind of cocktail hour and have martinis.
When we moved north and went up to Camp Eagle, we rotated out to different fire bases. And being a combat engineer with the demolition team, sometimes we were assigned to go out on an operation with them, and a lot of times they'd come into a complex and they needed to destroy it, so they'd call for an engineer team, and when the water and stuff come in, they'd throw us on the chopper with explosives, and then we'd bring in our ordnance and then blow up the complex and things. But a lot of the times we would just be out walking with the infantry, and the riflemen just like the grunt, and then when it's all done, the shooting stops and the engineers get your stuff out and blow up stuff. We should have been paid twice.
Within a month, the Eagles had completed their training in-country and embarked on their first combat missions.
First 10 months in-country was all around between Saigon, north of the border, and the areas that I mentioned. That was our area of operation. Rice paddy area, jungles. Tay Nin was a crazy place. There was the rice paddies and a big open area, and out in the middle, like some kind of a painting that somebody drew, there was this beautiful mountain right in the middle. It's called the Black Virgin Mountain. And while we were working in that area, there was ferocious firefights going on. They tell me there was a special forces and a communications center on top of the mountain, and the bird dogs are out running and chasing and going up into the mountain after them, and the whole thing was honeycombed with tunnels and caves and stuff. So it was their mountain, and here we had a place on top and pursuing and engaging whenever we could find the enemy.
I remember at night we could see that there was no boat traffic in the little harbor. But at night, all those little things out there, little junks with their lights on, you know, their dinging bells, you know, and the ducks down there for the coastline. And it's almost like a picture postcard. You know, certain areas of Vietnam were quite beautiful.
In December 1967, just 23 years after the battling bastards of Bastogne had celebrated Christmas by holding out against impossible odds and a larger, better-supplied enemy in the bitter cold of the Ardennes, the newest generation of Screaming Eagles had their Christmas in Southeast Asia and a tradition familiar to their fathers.
There's a high-flying bird way up in the sky, and I wonder, does he look down as he flies on by, riding on the air so easy in the sky.